Hello and welcome to the Saxo Market Call. This is our special edition looking at the Q4 2020 outlook. You can find for the written outlook, you can find it on analysis.saxo. And I must say, for myself at least, I'm really looking forward to this quarter because I think we're going to be seeing a lot happening. I think that's very much reflected in this outlook. If we look back at this year, Q2, of course, we were dealing with the unfolding of the pandemic and sort of recover from the emergency phase in March. Q3 saw some continuation with concerns about resurgence. And then in Q4, hopefully we're going to see maybe what the other side of COVID looks like to a degree, or whether we can get to the other side of COVID and see that and begin that process beginning. And especially our biggest focus, it's the U.S. election. Now, Stijn, you wrote in your introduction that this U.S. election will be one like we've never seen before. We've also got this idea that the policy response has shaped a K-shaped recovery. Take us through the combination. I think there's a real key combination to both that K-shaped recovery narrative and what we can expect leading into this U.S. election.
So I think what makes this election vastly different from anyone we've seen, at least in my lifetime, of course, is the fact and the pure fact that on November 4th, the morning after the actual election, we will not be able, most likely, to call the winner of the election. And that's, of course, due to this huge amount of mail votes that needs to be counted. And state by state, they have different rules. We could have theoretically 3, 4 weeks, but in best case, probably inside a week, depending on the outcome of the overall election. That's number one. The second part, of course, being that Trump, who now looks to be losing, is very likely to contest the actual result. And as you very well know, John, there's no precedent in American history for not accepting defeat. But it seems like that Trump and his base feels like that they need to continue this rally to make America great again. Except for the fact they're doing exactly the opposite. But that's another day, another story. But that's number one. But as we look at the economy, we have sort of said that we like the letter K as the letter to use for the economy, mainly because it encapsulates what goes on in the market itself, where we see technology and certain amount of sectors doing extremely well, healthcare obviously, and other sectors like leisure, travel is under huge pressure at the lower end of the K. But also socially, we see the same sort of letter to be used. The monetary policy of QE, the easy money, the zero interest rate, facilitates an asset increase in price and an asset inflation that really only benefits, if you're very diplomatic, the 10% of the population. But in earnest, it's probably less than 1% of the population that really benefits from this. And finally, of course, in the actual economy, we have the fact that these company and technology sector, healthcare and others, online sales, retail sales is doing relatively well. But again, in terms of employment, in terms of ability to navigate the incoming changes that has been provided for the COVID-19 and the shock to the system, basically means that we are caught in an ever-expanding fiscal support, an ever-expanding QE support from the central bank. And underneath this, and this is one of the main themes that we have right now and going into 2021, of course, being that we are monetizing that. So we are effectively using the balance sheet of the central banks to facilitate and finance the massive amount of fiscal stimulus that happens throughout the world. And what that does to the economy is basically, unlike 8 and 9, where we only had money being printing into the banking system, in the crisis of 2020, we have money being printed to the banking system again and in greater size. But on top of that, we have money flowing directly, circumventing the banking system into the pockets of consumers through the government's use of this monetization and their ability through incentive structure, furloughs, and other things to activate real demand in the real economy, meaning that the demand of money is increasing, but outside the banking system, which is the misnomer and the misinterpretation that most of the market does. So overall, John, that's the K shape. That's the setup that we have. And in the short term, we think there'll be more K. In the medium term, we think there'll be more K economy, but with inflation. And ultimately, we think the K will lead to stagflation.
And that's a key point you make in your introduction. The point about the central banks have become enablers of the fiscal side, but they're actually not the ones providing the actual stimulus checks to the people. So it really is the focus, doesn't it? I think, as you point out as well, the focus really switches very dramatically from here on out to the fiscal authority, to the government policy, away from the central banks being the sort of masters of the universe that we've become accustomed to them being over the last couple of decades.
Absolutely. And that's also why the market has accepted a far smaller size of a fiscal stimulus going into the election. And that is predicated on the fact that if there is a Biden sweep, we will see an even larger sized fiscal response. In the process, of course, it seems like investors for now are willing to accept that the tax rate in the US under Biden will go from 21 to 26. There'll be a minimum tax threshold that needs to be paid. The richest 1% of the population will need to finance 70% of the tax increases that happens on the personal tax income. And on top of that, I think there is increased risk for technology in terms of the monopoly. So it's kind of interesting that how the narrative has shifted even during the process under which the outlook Q4 outlook 4 was produced by our people. It's really changed dramatically from accepting almost now in full that Biden will have a clean sweep. And with this clean sweep, we will just see more K, so to speak, in the terminology just used.
Yeah, and that's a really key thing. I mean, the key thing about the outcome in this election, Peter, you have to agree, I would assume, just like in 2016, but in a very different way, the outcomes are extremely different. And we talk about this clean sweep of the Democrats. That really is the option that creates the most immediate implications into equities from a valuation perspective, but also taxation, et cetera. So what are you seeing actually, you know, shaping up in different sectors ahead of the election? And what do you see after the election, especially in terms of a Biden sweep, in terms of what sectors will be favored and whether the market is maybe a bit complacent?
Well, first of all, I think it's important to note that the clean sweep for the Democrats was actually one of our outrageous predictions. I think that's a funny one because it was the single most hated outrageous prediction when we announced them back in January. People were calling us stupid for even suggesting such an outrageous claim. But now it actually looks like it could come true. Typical outrageous predictions. But coming back to your question, John, so if we assume a very strong Biden victory and the Democrats take the US Congress, I think a couple of things will happen. So there will be definitely a strong push for the green energy revolution that they have put out in their campaign. That means immediate support and more momentum, I think, to our green stocks basket, which was up 80% a couple of weeks ago when we last time checked, because there's so much political willpower coming through both in Europe and China, but now with the US lacking, but that could come under the Biden administration. But I think, as Steen said, the narrative has suddenly changed for everything to be good under a Biden administration for equities. And I'm still not convinced because I think Biden learned for Hillary's lack of winning or her losing to Trump that he will need to cater to the growing strength of the left side of the Democratic Party. And they want something on the table. And that includes higher corporate tax rate, as Steen already mentioned. But Biden have also suggested a doubling of the GILTI tax, which is basically a tax on global income flowing from intangibles. And that will hit healthcare, communication services, where you find Google and Facebook, but also software and digital companies in general, where you find Apple and Amazon to some extent. And those sectors have been the best performing. So if you look at the Trump 4 years, it was the communication services, it was the healthcare, and it was the technology sector that made the majority of the gain. So I'm still convinced that a Biden victory is a net negative for equities. But I think in the short term, the market will probably price a higher probability for that, a bigger fiscal stimulus that could come under a consensus deal ahead of the election by the Democrats and Republicans. So I think there will be hangovers.
And as well, and maybe not for the median stock in the U.S. Equity market universe, but these FANG stocks and the multi-trillion dollar growth in their market caps over this period, it has to come under question if we're talking about breakups or the risk of these monopolies being broken up. And that's not just an idle threat. It's been bandied about, but as recently as this last week, we've seen some results from a House panel actually looking into a very long-term study into how these companies' practices are creating monopolies. So I guess certainly for aggregate market cap, again, not the median stock, that would also be a massive question for the popularity of those FANGs names and of course, their success.
I think regardless whether it's Trump or Biden, I actually think that we're looking into a period where small caps in the U.S. will do a comeback. simply because of the nationalism and then or the nationalistic focus, but also the fiscal impulses that will definitely drive small caps. And we talked about it in our podcast earlier today, our daily podcast, John, that you can see in Europe that the small caps are really gaining relative to large caps. And I think we actually will swing back to that environment also in the US after the election.
Yeah, and I want to get back to you staying shortly on the outlook for inflation, because we definitely have an outlook because of the shift in policy focus and fiscal forcing where we're looking for an inflationary outcome down the road. But first, Ola, over to you. The focus on green, the trauma of COVID-19 and what it did to the oil market. Right now, we're all talking about a supply overhang in the market. But of course, with that, those low prices, we're seeing complete lack of investment in a you know, commodity space that needs tons of investment just to maintain production. What's your outlook for especially oil and relative to green energy and so on in the coming quarter and into 2021?
Well, the market is, just like the other sectors, are pricing in increasingly a Biden win. We also, I think, starting to see that in the energy space, because Biden obviously has a more greener agenda than the current one being presented by Trump. And that could potentially, well, inadvertently will have a supportive impact on the price of oil over the coming years. But obviously in the short term, and by that I mean probably the next 6 to 12 months, we continue to basically have these two uncertainties. We got, well, not the certainty, on one side, we got the production cuts from OPEC Plus, which has helped to stabilize the market. On the other hand, we got the pandemic, which continues to be delayed we cannot see the light at the end of the tunnel just yet. And that's obviously keeping demand lower than where we would expect just a few months ago. So I think on that basis, give or take a few hurricanes, which is upsetting the Gulf Coast in the U.S., we probably will see Brent crude stuck around this in the low 40s here for the potentially for the remaining part of 2020. But we do see higher prices as we move into 2021 and potentially even higher in 2022 when the impact of this lack of investment starts to filter through to the prices.
All right, and I want to get your thoughts on precious metals shortly, but I think part of that story on precious metals very much bound up in the inflation story. And Stain, take us through why, especially the shift, I guess, to a fiscal focus, and for whatever other reasons, you're seeing this big shift to an inflationary regime, unlike perhaps we've seen in decades.
So first of all, I think we need to define, when we talk about inflation, what we really mean by inflation is inflation expectations. Because in history, when you look at inflation, it's not realized inflation that drives the additional sort of direction on inflation itself, but the expectation of the inflation. That's certainly what we saw in the 30s and what we saw in the 70s. And if you look back in the 1970s, it is impossible to pinpoint, apart from the OPEC crisis, the oil crisis, what really elevated the inflation in the 1970s and created a stagflation. But it happened in a macro framework of big business, social rioting, changes, monopolistic structures in the market, which of course is keywords that also has some value today in 2020. But the primary driver from a economist's point of view is the following. The big change from 2008-2009 crisis was that the response and the policy response overall in 2008-2009 was entirely driven by printing more money by the central banks. As you all remember, we had a very austere Europe. We had in particular a very austere Northern Europe. And overall, every single government at the time was very, very proud of holding back on fiscal spending. This ability to spend money came with the COVID-19. We now have Germany spending 20% of GDP, the US 27% of GDP. We have retail sales in Germany going up and the likes. And that just proves the point that we have been trying to make for the past 6 months since the COVID-19 crisis. And that is that when central banks becomes vehicles and vehicles only to finance deficit of governments. In the present slide deck we use overall, I have a very boring table, but a very instructive table from Morgan Stanley that says that the expected increase in Fed's balance sheet to the end of 2021 is 17% of GDP. And that is a massive expansion on all of it, all of the 17% of expansion is direct financing of the fiscal spend that the US election is about right now. So in other words, the money being printed today doesn't go to the banking system, but circumvents the banking system and goes directly into the pocket of the consumer. The consumer at the same time is then forced to stay put, to have staycation and all these words. They are reducing the amount of travel, the amount of holidays. And I just briefly calculated, you know, for a European family of five people, the net saving for not going on an overseas holiday is in the neighborhood of conservatively 15,000 euros to 30,000 euros of additional spend they have. This money is being spent in retail. We see it even in Germany. It's been spent on durable goods overall. And durable goods would always be the main driver of inflation from the demand side. And what we see right now is that durable inflation numbers is up between 4 and 6%. Unit labor cost is up 8 to 10%. A lot of people are skeptical that unit labor costs will continue to go up because, of course, in the labor market, the weakest sector of the labor market is losing their job. So whoever remains in work, at work, in employment is, of course, getting a marginally higher price due to this averaging out. I happen to think that a lot of these jobs will never come back. So I think the constitution of the labor market going forward will certainly be more driven by people who have the ability to also negotiate a better salary. But certainly durable goods is the one. So, John, you know, long answer to a short question, but basically monetization means the money goes directly through the central banks into the hands of the consumer. In the case of the US, the consumer remains 70% of the economy. In the UK, it's probably 80%. And in Northern Europe, we are moving slowly from 40, 50, 60 into also 70% of the population. Basically, we have nothing else to do but to consume in a world of apps and streaming TV.
That's actually provides an interesting segue into what I think will be the prominent feature in the FX market next year of a weaker dollar, because a lot of this focus on the stimulus side during the COVID-19 crisis in the US at least has been just simply putting money in people's hands to keep them in their with shelter, with food, with some of this, the money to spend. And ironically, US incomes actually rose during the crisis too at a record rate. And a lot of that spending, since the US doesn't produce very much of the stuff that it consumes, a lot of that spending went straight to China. And we saw some record trade deficits, US-China, ironically, in the era of Trump, developing from that. And that brings us to the issue of external US deficits and other nations' willingness to take those dollars and then recycle them back into the US dollar will be very doubtful in an inflationary world and where the dollar is losing value. So I think that's just the key long-term story of dollar decline. A couple of things that I think will slow that dollar decline a little bit are if a Biden and a Democratic clean sweep government focuses more on proper investing in the US and infrastructure and in building up various businesses, something more strategic than simply flooding consumers' pockets with cash to spend on daily necessities and other goods, durable or otherwise. And the fact that this dollar weakness and will drive other countries to do similar programs to avoid their own currencies from strengthening too much. This is the classic currency war or competitive devaluation game that I think will be played, which means that inflation is a threat, not just in the US, but also elsewhere. It also means we need something to protect ourselves against inflation. With many equities richly valued, we want, in some cases, hard assets. What's the hardest asset, Ola? Is it gold?
Well,
and that's part of the gold story, right?
It is part of the gold
rhetorical
story.
Rhetorical question, obviously. And that's, yeah.
And obviously, you both gave me a lead in because talk about inflation and talk about a weaker dollar, it really does play into the hands of commodities in general, but I think probably specifically into gold, where we obviously already so far this year have seen a phenomenal amount of investment interest, ETF holdings up by 1/3 since January. And I think that trend is likely to continue. What we're also seeing now elsewhere is the emerging price pressure coming in from the food side. For agricultural commodities have basically had their best quarter, third quarter since 2016. Food prices generally are moving higher, led by grains and the oil seed sector. And with that, added to that, the risk of a renewed weather phenomenon, the El Niño, which potentially could have add some further upside pressure to price over the coming months. So it's just setting up the I think the stage for continued increase in some of these metals. And with gold, we basically talk about reaching 2000 again before year end, and potentially moving even higher into 2021. So inflation, weaker dollar, really is two keys. And I think also adding to that, we saw Warren Buffett a few months ago moving into Barrick Gold. He's not been touching gold for decades, but suddenly he went into Barrick. He's going for the dividend, and he's also going for the inflation hedge. So he's kind of showing the way, I think, for many, that this is potentially an area where you need to have some more attention over the coming months.
And don't forget, he also bought a group of five trading companies in Japan. So there's also definitely, I think, the trajectory.
Which are having commodity trading.
Having commodity trading, that's one off. But then also they price in Japanese yen. So it seems like there's a wish by Berkshire Hathaway to diversify their wealth across different currencies and be more focused on the resource part of the economy. So clearly, if you believe Berkshire Hathaway is an informed investor and better than the average, then I think that's a signal in itself.
Yes. And I think another key point we need to talk about here, if we're talking about inflation, the worst thing to hold in the world is bonds. Bonds have been a cornerstone of portfolios and a high mix in those portfolios for decades now. The 60-40 classic, this whole risk parity paradigm, et cetera. Stain, I think you've been really, you've really bent over backwards to emphasize that you think there's a need to reassess how we're allocating assets from here. And just take us through briefly what that means in terms of the 60-40 model and where we should be allocating our assets from here.
So we are saying that the 60-40 model is broken despite all of the success it's had over the last 20 years. The reason for that, of course, is the fixed income component, which has contributed only 1% less than equity overall in terms of its net return and its protection in terms of the divergence from risk on in the equity space. So basically at zero interest rate, at zero coupon in the US effectively, there is very, very little potential earnings in terms of coupon or holding onto these assets going forward. It is a big pocket of investment. The fixed income market is about four or five times bigger than the equity market in size. So when money flows out of fixed income, it will go into smaller pockets of capital, which from a trader's perspective is very interesting. So what we are saying and what we are sort of advocating from onwards here is not really to change the long equity and long fixed income. We are presently giving 35% to fixed to equity, 20% to government bonds. But the remaining 45%, we split almost equally between inflation link, volatility, gold and commodity trending. And the reason for that is that it's exactly the same that we just discussed. If the fixed income is giving you no return and no negative correlation, you need to buy a negative correlation first and foremost. That is, so to speak, your fire insurance. That fire insurance is volatility. So that makes sense. If you then believe, as we do, that there is a monetization and a debasement of currency, which includes a weaker dollar, as you just stated, then of course gold becomes something you also need in the portfolio. And of course, again, on top of that, you can add geopolitical risk, China, US, and the likes that comes past the election. And finally, on the inflation linked, I think we made a decent case of saying that the expected inflation at least will increase. But remember, when money flows from a very high volatility, sorry, very high liquidity function like fixed government bonds and go into small pockets like inflation link, first of all, there's no allocation overall in the world to the inflation. And secondly, when the money starts to flow into these inflation linkers, they will become more than intrinsic value worth simply because of the flow becomes so dominant, not unequal to what we have recently seen in the green transformation space, where we see the solar panels ETF making new all-time high, the green tech making all-time new high. So, you know, so this theme has a tendency to catch on. So basically for us, constructing a portfolio throughout the election and going into 21, but all the way to 2030, means you need to focus on the weaker sides of your portfolio. We think the market overall has two major risks, and that is volatility and higher inflation rates. Whether it comes or not is not really relevant for your portfolio construction. You need to have a counterbalance to those two things. And that dictates that we have a portfolio which is relatively high performing, which have, you know, 35% equity, 25% in fixed rate in government bonds, and then equally split 45% between volatility, inflation linked, commodity trending, and gold.
All right, now zooming back into our Q4, particularly, there's some really strategic things in there that we need to consider, of course, especially because the policy environment is likely to pick up in this direction and next year post-election. But the election itself is very interesting when you talk about volatility, how the market is actually trying to price this. Peter, I know you have some thoughts on that. There's been a lot of talk about it. It's the most significantly priced volatility event ever. But what does that mean in practical terms for the outlook here?
Well, we looked at all the elections going back to 1896, so 31 election, U.S. elections, and we looked at how equities were performing, and we looked at the realized volatility post an election, and it's very close to the sort of the average volatility annualized you expect to see in equities, so around 16-17%. What we're currently looking at in the VIX futures is that we have a very steep VIX futures curve. So the futures pricing what the VIX will be at a future point. So the curve is upward sloping for the current VIX spot index, and then it comes down again on the other side of the election. But we're currently looking at VIX futures around 34 level, which indicates a 34% annualized volatility over a 30-day period. So trying to keep it in plain, simple English, is that rich? I mean, is that cheap or is it expensive? I think it's quite expensive. If we look back in history, there's only been three periods of these elections where we had a realized volatility that was higher than what the current VIX futures are pricing. And that was in 1916 during World War One, 1932 during the second part of the depression trade or the slump in equities. And then in 2008, when you had almost 100-year event with the financial and credit crisis. If you play the devil's advocate here, can it even get worse than it's currently priced in? Of course it could. And then the contested election obviously being one scenario, but the question is how big is the probability for that? Don't put too much weight on a young equity guy like me. I'm typically have a positive bias, so I would probably be selling volatility at the current VIX futures level. That could be a horrible trade if I'm wrong. I just feel like a lot of bad things are priced in relative to what will actually happen. But that's a trade. You can either agree or disagree, but that's at least my personal view, that I think the VIX futures are pricing in something that is not going to happen. Basically.
Okay. You're not that young anymore, Peter.
John.
You're a lot younger than me, but so not that young anymore. Okay. But I think it just goes back to the point, though, that it is this election that will be very interesting to see the other side of and to get this, see how the probabilities shape up relative to the polls, which do seem to be at this point in time, this snapshot, we're less than a month away from the election, are showing that the odds are increasing of a Biden win in a clean sweep. But we'll see. I think we've taken you through a lot of issues here, some things to chew on, some things to think about portfolio allocation, the risk of the election itself, and what this election will mean for assets going forward, as well as the policy environment going forward. And the COVID-19 vaccine, still a huge question mark in the background. We do not have answers for that, but it's going to linger as well as an issue for sure. For now, we thank you for joining the special podcast, and best of luck to you, and stay careful out there. And we'll be back, of course, next week with our usual daily market call podcast. For today, thanks for joining.